Can one be a pragmatic idealist? At first glance, this term, the pairing of these words, seems to be an oxymoron. Idealism evokes in our mind a worldview, a philosophy that views our fellow man, that views our community, our society, as fundamentally good, as fundamentally compassionate, as fundamentally cooperative, as fundamentally sharing and acting upon the same values that we share and that we act upon. That is the basis of idealism. In contrast, pragmatism, to our mind, evokes a worldview that's filled with cynicism, with suspicion, a worldview in which a person's neighbor, in which a person's counterpart is viewed as possibly seeking to prey upon one's own better nature, and therefore in which one's neighbor and counterpart is viewed as an adversary to be guarded against, rather than as a friend with whom to cooperate. And hence, idealism and pragmatism seem to be fundamentally at odds with one another. That's at first glance. I believe, however, that halacha demands of its adherents that they truly be pragmatic idealists. Halacha believes that these two concepts, that these two worldviews or courses of action not only can be synthesized, but must be synthesized. Pragmatism and idealism are not opposites. The real opposite of idealism is realism. The real opposite of pragmatism is naivete. Idealism and realism are two worldviews. They're philosophical constructs which enable a person to place the events of his life, both the past, the present, and the anticipated future, into a context, into a schema. They're philosophical systems. Naivete and pragmatism, on the other hand, are not philosophical systems. They are patterns of conduct, patterns of action. A naive person acts in an unsuspecting manner. A naive person does not take precautions to guard himself against becoming the prey for opportunists. A pragmatic person adopts a code of conduct wherein he is constantly on guard against those opportunists that should happen to exist. But fundamentally, a pragmatist may subscribe to the philosophical system which views most or even all men as fundamentally good at heart and therefore as friends rather than as adversaries. Before jumping into the topic of this shiur, I want to illustrate this thesis with perhaps the most powerful example that I have. The story of Gedaliah ben Achikam, the governor of Eretz Yisrael, immediately following the destruction of the First Temple, whose assassination we still mourn every year on the third day of Tishrei, on the day immediately following Rosh Hashanah. Who was Gedaliah ben Achikam? What led to his downfall? What perspective do Chazal, the arbiters of a moral and ethical perspective on Jewish history, adapt towards Gedaliah's actions and his downfall? Let's take a look at this story. In Sefer Yirmiyahu, chapters 39 and 40, we are presented with an astonishing turnaround from hope to despair. If we read through the Pesukim, we'll discover that in the aftermath of the temple's destruction, the Babylonians were kindly disposed towards the remnant of the Jewish nation, which they permitted to stay in Eretz Yisrael. They allowed this remnant the privilege of self-government. Not only of self-government, but of self-government through a scion of the Davidic dynasty. Practically a king. And this governor, Gedaliah ben Achikam, who was appointed by the king of Babel, was a charismatic figure. He was a symbol of hope, a rallying point, both for the remnants of the war-torn Jewish nation in Eretz Yisrael, and for all those Jews who had fled from the upcoming destruction to foreign nations. And therefore, the Psukim tell us that following Gedaliah's appointment, the generals who remained to the Jewish nation rallied around him. The remaining simple men of the Jewish nation rallied around him. And not only that, but there was an inpouring, an immigration of Jews from all of the surrounding countries, from Moab, from Ammon, from Edom, from all the countries, who heard that the king of Babylon had left a remnant of Judah and that he had set over them Gedaliah, the son of Achikam, the son of Shaphan. Then all the Jews returned out of the places whither they were driven and came to the land of Judah, to Gedaliah, to the Mitzpah, and gathered wine and summer fruits in great abundance. I just quoted to you Psukim Tes through Yud Beis of Perek Lamed Tes and Sefer Yirmiyahu. So it's a period of tremendous hope. And Gedaliah swears to the Jews that he will protect them and he will intercede for their good on with the Babylonians who are occupying the land, and he will leave them to pursue the gathering of provisions for the winter. And so they set about gathering provisions, and all is looking well. Let's skip for a second to after the critical point and look at the end of the story. Yishmael, the son of Netanyah, assassinates Gedaliah. He assassinates the governor. Not only that, but treasonously, he perpetrates a massacre upon a large number of Jews. He fills to the brim with corpses a large pit that had been dug outside of the mitzvah many decades earlier. He fills it with corpses of men who are faithful, who owe their allegiance to Gedaliah. He takes captive much of the remainder of Gedaliah's loyal followers and sets out with these captives to defect to the country of Ammon. And even though the assassin Yishmael is ultimately pursued, and ultimately the captives are freed, ultimately Yishmael flees ignominiously to the land of Ammon for many years, a land which was a sworn enemy of the Jewish nation. However, with the assassination of Gedaliah, the people no longer feel safe in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore they prepare to descend to Egypt, where the prophet Yirmiyahu intercedes with them and asks, please don't, God has promised you safety in Egypt, even though Gedaliah is no longer here, God will guarantee your safety in Eretz Yisrael. But they don't listen to Yirmiyahu and they go down to Egypt. And not only that, but they adopt the pagan ways of their Egyptian neighbors, and therefore God swears to them that the very sword which they sought to escape in Egypt will descend upon them there and wipe out the remnants of the Jews whom the Babylonians had left in Eretz Yisrael. And in a very sad comment, Chazal tell us that for 52 years the land of Israel was desolate. Not only was it devoid of human inhabitants, but even as a consequence of this final Yiridav, this final departure from Eretz Yisrael, of the last remnant whom the Babylonians had left remain, that even the animals and even the fish and even the birds of the air abandoned Eretz Yisrael, so that there was not a breath of life stirring in the land for 52 years. Just imagine, from hope to despair, from Gedaliah's promise to intercede with, on behalf of the remnant, with the Babylonian government, from people peacefully and securely going about their winter preparations, to a land desolate of its human and animal inhabitants for 52 years. What critical event precipitated this dramatic shift in the history of the Jewish nation and in the land of Israel? The Navi tells us, Yochanan the son of Kereach and all the captains of the forces in the field came to Gedaliah to the mitzvah, and they said to him, Do you know that Baalis, the king of Ammon, has sent Yishmael the son of Nesaniah to take your life? A striking allegation. But Gedaliah ben Achikam did not believe it. Then Yochanan the son of Kereach spoke to Gedaliah secretly in Mitzpah, saying, Let me go, I beg you. I will slay Yishmael ben Netanya, and no one shall know it. Why should you allow him to take your life? Why should you allow him to scatter all the Jews that have gathered and rallied to you? Why should you permit the remnant of Yehuda to perish? But Gedaliah ben Achikam said to Yochanan ben Kereach, You shall not do this. You speak falsely of Yishmael. Now it came to pass in the seventh month that Yishmael ben Nesanya ben Alishama, who was of the royal seed, one of the chief officers of the king and 10 men with him, came to Gedaliah ben Achikam to the mitzvah, and they ate bread together in the mitzvah. Then Yishmael arose and the 10 men that were with him, and he smote Gedaliah ben Achikam ben Shaphan with a sword and slew him, whom the king of Babylon has appointed governor over the land. What just happened? Gedaliah was forewarned. Yochanan ben Kereach had warned him about Yishmael's duplicity. But Gedaliah did not believe him. And when Yochanan offered to preempt the catastrophe by assassinating the traitor, Gedaliah responded, You shall not do this thing, for you speak falsely about Yishmael. Chazal in Maseches Nida critique Gedaliah ben Achikam. They say, based on a pasuk, which describes all those who were murdered by the hand of Gedaliah. Did Gedaliah murder them? No. Gedaliah was their governor. He had promised to defend them and to intercede on their behalf with the Babylonians. It's explicit that Gedaliah's assassins murdered them. It was Gedaliah's assassin, Yishmael, who filled up this pit to the brim with the corpses of Gedaliah's followers. So why then does the pasuk attribute the murder of these followers to Gedaliah and not to Yishmael, who rightfully deserves the blame? And the Gemara answers that because Gedaliah had sworn to protect them, because the responsibility for their protection was in Gedaliah's hand, he ought to have been concerned, he ought to have investigated, he ought to have taken precautions. When he heard the rumors, when he heard the allegations, that there were schemes upon his life. And because Gedaliah discredited these allegations and neglected to take the proper precautions, he, Gedaliah, is held liable for the death of his followers and for the deterioration of the Jewish situation in Eretz Yisrael. Powerful, powerful. Chazal understand that Gedaliah did not act properly, that he should have given more credence to these allegations. What was Gedaliah thinking? What was he thinking? The Chafetz Chaim, in source number 8, explains. Gedaliah ben Achika was a great man, and certainly did not transgress the prohibition against standing idly by when one's compatriot's blood is at risk. But regarding Lashon Hara, he had a different position. That one may not accept Lashon Hara, may not even be concerned lest it be true. The halacha, Gedaliah believed, was that a person must assume that any Lashon Hara, any reports which would seek to undermine his belief in the good nature of his counterpart, of his fellow man, of his neighbor, must be assumed to be false. One may not even entertain the possibility that they are true. This was Gedaliah ben Achikam, the governor's considered halachic position. And therefore he felt duty-bound to deny and discredit the rumors and the allegations that he had heard against Yishmael ben Netanya. To discredit them not only to the point of neglecting to take precautions, but to the point of neglecting to investigate their truth. Because a person's response, Gedaliah believed, to such allegations must be to continue acting as if he had never heard them. And just like without the allegations, he would never have suspected the duplicity of Yishmael, after having heard the allegations, he felt that he was not allowed to even suspect Yishmael of duplicity. This was the position of Gedaliah for which he is blamed and castigated by Chazal. The proper perspective, Chazal say, is to be pragmatic, is to investigate at the very least, and to take precautions even, lest the rumors be true. And so, whereas Gedaliah was a pure idealist, he was an idealist in worldview and naive in practice. Chazal agree that a person should be an idealist in worldview and should not jump to conclusions, should not believe with absolute certainty that the allegations and rumors against Yishmael are correct. But at the same time, a person is forbidden from being naive in conduct and practice. A person must be pragmatic in conduct and practice. A person must investigate the rumors. A person must take precautions lest the rumors be true. Let's return for a second. I'll give you two quick scenarios which I don't want to analyze at present, but which should indicate to us some areas where it's critical, practically, lemaisa, for us to arrive at some sort of synthesis between idealism and pragmatism. Scenario number one. Let's say that you are a parent or a principal of a school where one of the teachers is rumored to be a child abuser. What do you do? There is no concrete evidence at present. Are you allowed to take punitive action against that teacher? Are you allowed to take defensive action against that teacher? To caution, perhaps, the children to never remain alone with him? To post an assistant in the room to supervise his actions and make sure that he's never alone with the child? Are you obligated to place somebody to shadow him at all times? And at the very least, are you permitted or obligated to make further inquiries into the matter? And what can one do, or what must one do, what should one do, if the further inquiries don't bear any fruit, and they cannot prove with any degree of substance that the allegations are true? What does one do then? Gedalia ben Achikam, we know what he would do. He would feel that you should not take precautions, you should not even launch an investigation. Chazal, it seems, would demand, or at least permit, the launching of an investigation. Would they permit posting a shadow on this teacher? We have to think about it. Perhaps by the end of this year, we'll be more qualified to answer this question. But again, I don't intend to return to it, so you'll have to consider the relevance of the sources that I bring on your own. Here's a second scenario. What happens if you're the general of an army or the leader of an organization and you hear rumors that one of your lieutenants, one of your administrators, has defected to the enemy and is channeling to them confidential information? What may you do and what must you do? May you take punitive action against them? Can you lock them up? Can you have them court-martialed? Can you fire them? Can you at the very least restrict their access to privileged information? Can you post somebody to shadow them? Can you launch an investigation? And if you may do any or all of these things, which of them must you do? This is all things that must be considered. Again, we know what Gedalia would have done. He would have done nothing. He would have felt that you must continue to act after the allegations as you would have acted had you not heard them. We know what Chazal would have you do at the minimum, launch an investigation. Would Chazal have you take defensive action? Probably yes. Would they have you take punitive action? Probably not. It becomes difficult. What happens if you're truly worried that before you can finish the investigation, that it'll already be too late? What if defensive action may not be sufficient? These are difficult questions. Let's go back through the sources. I believe that upon analysis of the relevant sources, we'll discover that there are a number of variables which need to be determined before we can arrive at a conclusive answer to any of these questions. The presence of rumors is but one variable. There are many other variables that we must consider. I want to devote the remainder of this shiur to analyzing what those variables are from the perspective of halachic precedent. Because even if you consider on your own what variables are relevant and what variables are not, it's important to appreciate that the role of a posek, the role of a gadol, not that I claim to be one, but at the very least I can describe to you the role that they play, is to spend their lives in pursuit of understanding what Hashem wants people to do, to spend their lives immersed in Torah so that they have the broadest and most comprehensive grasp of halachic precedent. And by doing so, by devoting their lives to this cause, being capable of discerning between which variables are significant and which are insignificant, which are relevant to the case at hand, and which are irrelevant. And so I want to consider, you probably have in your own head an idea of which variables are relevant and which variables are irrelevant. I want to just survey briefly what I have found thus far in the sources of halachic precedent regarding which variables are relevant and which are irrelevant. The first thing that we have to consider is, what are the consequences? What if the rumors are true? What will we be obligated to do? And what if the rumors are genuinely false? What would we be obligated to do? Only after knowing these two things can we determine what we should do out of uncertainty. Because our uncertainty concerns not only what took place in the past and what takes place at the present, our uncertainty fundamentally relates to how we should conduct ourselves in the future. It relates to how we should choose between two possible paths of conduct, each path of conduct being the consequence of a certain series of past and present events. But the fundamental uncertainty is how we should conduct ourselves. And therefore, we must know what are the different paths of conduct which we would be obligated to follow should one side or the other of this uncertainty be discovered true. So let's look at different scenarios. Let's take for a second the scenario of Gedalia ben Achikam. Were it true that Yishmael was a traitor, what would Gedalia's obligation have been? The Rambam tells us in source number 1 that there are 3 mitzvos, 3 commandments, which demand of us to protect our fellow man, to save him from all those who have designs upon his life or his comfort and livelihood. The Rambam says that if you know of a murder conspiracy against your friend, and you have the capability of foiling that conspiracy, you're obligated to foil it. If you neglect to do so, you have transgressed 3 commandments. That's a basic summary of the Rambam. Indeed, halakha takes this further. If someone is pursuing his friend with murderous intent, you are obligated to save the one who is being pursued. You're obligated to save the one who is being pursued, even at the cost of the life of the pursuer. If you can save him through other means, that's better. But if you cannot, you must take the life of the pursuer. In the case of Gedalia, the assassin, the traitor, Yishmael ben Netanya, was pursuing Gedalia. He had designs on Gedalia's life. Not only that, he had designs on the lives of all of Gedalia's followers, as evidenced by the fact that subsequent to Gedalia's assassination, he proceeded to murder Gedalia's followers. Not only that, he was threatening and jeopardizing the entire future of the Jewish nation in Eretz Yisrael. And as such, clearly, these three mitzvos which the Rambam mentions apply. Anybody aware of Yishmael's plat who neglects to foil that plat has transgressed three mitzvos. Ideally, the plat should be foiled without having to take Yishmael's life. But if necessary, Yishmael's life is forfeit because of his murderous designs. As an aside, it's actually interesting. It's clear from the Psukim that Yochanan ben Kereach and the other generals, the other leaders of the Jewish people, who had sworn their allegiance to Gedaliah, were aware of this assassination attempt. Why then did they ask Gedaliah's permission and not act based on their knowledge? It's an interesting question. Perhaps they too have some share of the blame, because they had an obligation to save Gedaliah's life, to save the lives of Gedaliah's followers, to save the Jewish future, and they neglected to do that. There may be reasons to explain why they didn't. They may have actually been valid in not acting, and rather in going to Gedaliah, but it's something which needs to be considered. So that's what they would have to do if the rumors were true. They would have to save themselves and save their compatriots, even at the expense of Yishmael's life. If the rumors are false, clearly they cannot take any punitive action against Yishmael, nor can they even take, should they even take defensive action. In this case, defensive action is something which they can do without a problem. It doesn't hurt to sleep in your armor and carry a sword at your side and go around in groups to stall the assassination attempt. There's no halacha against doing this. So they would have been permitted to do it, but not obligated. The case of uncertainty, therefore, would be weighted in favor of taking precautions. There are no liabilities in taking precautions. One would not transgress anything, and one would only stand to gain. Gedaliah, as we mentioned earlier from the Chafetz Chaim, held that it was forbidden to take precautions because that would compromise their idealism. But Chazal say that there's an obligation to take precautions because there's an obligation to be a pragmatic idealist or an idealistic pragmatist. Let's turn now to another case where it's a little more difficult, where a person stands to sacrifice on some moral and ethical value no matter which side of the uncertainty is true. And that's a case which is discussed in the Gemara in Maseches Nida. The Gemara tells of two people who came to Rabbi Tarfon, and these people were rumored to have murdered, to be on the wanted list of their local government. And they came to Rabbi Tarfon, the leader of the Jewish community, and requested refuge. They requested asylum. And Rabbi Tarfon made the following calculation. If the rumors are true, then I'm obligated to surrender you to the authorities. Not only can I not hide you, can I not grant you asylum and refuge, I must do the exact opposite. I must turn you over to the police. If the rumors are false and you're being unjustly pursued, I have an obligation to hide you. Lo sam od adam riecha. I cannot stand idly by and allow you to be wrongly persecuted or wrongly executed. There's an ethical value which demands a certain code of conduct, no matter whether this side is true, that side is true. The problem is that these two modes of conduct are in conflict with one another. If the rumors are true, I must surrender you. If the rumors are false, I must hide you. What do I do? Says Rabbi Tarfon. I won't surrender you, and I won't hide you. Go hide yourselves. That was Rabbi Tarfon's response. Clearly, this case is much more difficult than the case of Gedalia. In the case of Gedalia, the path of conduct that one must take if the rumors are true does not demand an abrogation of any ethical responsibility. Again, to sleep in armor and to have a sword nearby is not forbidden. In the case of Rabbi Tarfon, however, it's not the same. The path of conduct that I have to take if the rumors are true is diametrically opposite. I'd be obligated to hand you over to the authorities, which would be absolutely forbidden if the rumors are false. And the path of conduct I would have to take if the rumors are false, namely to hide you, is absolutely forbidden if the rumors are true. And so Rabbi Tarfon adopts a middle ground. He doesn't hide them, but he doesn't turn them in. It looks like we're running out of time. So I want to very quickly, very briefly summarize some of the variables which the poskim have brought to bear on this situation. Question number one, what are the projected consequences of different courses of action? What are the projected consequences of giving this guy asylum, of giving the guy refuge? Rashi says the projected consequences are minimal. If you give him refuge, you will have violated your obligation to uphold justice by turning him in. But you don't actually cause yourself or your community to be in danger. Tosfos, in the name of She'iltos de Rabbi Achai, says no. If that were the case, if the projected consequences of granting him refuge and asylum are minimal, you would be obligated to grant him refuge, because the projected consequences of not granting him refuge are far more catastrophic. So you just have to analyze what are the consequences. You're taking a much greater risk, or you're risking a much more horrific outcome by turning him away than by taking him in. So Tosfos says, if truly the consequences of taking him in are minimal, are merely the violation of an ethical imperative, you would be obligated to take them in and give them refuge. But in this case, says Tosfos, the consequences are more serious, because the government is going to harm anyone who abets a suspected murderer. If you give them asylum, then you too and your family and community are liable to come to harm. And only under such circumstances are you permitted to turn them away. And the Chafetz Chaim adds on something else. Didn't we say this guy is a suspected murderer? He's wanted by the government for murder? Okay, you don't know whether it's true or whether it's not true, but you're endangering yourself and your family if you allow a murderer into your home. Because who's to say that he's going to keep you safe and not turn violent on you? So one set of variables that one has to analyze when determining whether to be more of an idealist or more of a pragmatist is, what are the consequences of adapting a mostly idealistic perspective, of believing that these people requesting asylum are really good? Are the consequences negligible? Or are the consequences potentially disastrous? What are the consequences of being a pragmatist? What are the consequences of handing these people in? Again, in different countries, in different localities, in different time periods, the consequences are likely to be very different. Living now in the United States of America, so we have much more faith in the justice system than we did for much of our historical existence amongst nations which were not as kind as the United States and not as just as the United States, in nations where justice was a thin disguise for anti-Semitism, we obviously were much more suspicious about handing in a person to the authorities. Even nowadays, we're somewhat suspicious of it, but leaving that aside, the consequences are potentially that you're giving up this person's life. Handing over a person to hostile authorities is akin to murder. So that's also pretty serious. If it were less serious, if the consequences were less serious, if the consequences of pragmatism were less serious, then perhaps we would be more inclined towards adopting a pragmatic perspective. To understand, and let's say that the consequences of being pragmatic are to deprive a person of his livelihood, and that's all. So there's a discussion, the Chafetz Chaim discusses this. What happens if a person who's known as an honest collector of money is suddenly rumored to be dishonest and to be collecting even though he doesn't deserve it? May one withhold charity from him, says the Chafetz Chaim? One may not withhold charity from him. But in this case, it's another variable to consider. The consequences are not the possible death of the person who's a subject of the rumors, but rather the consequences are loss of livelihood. So that's one thing which must be considered. And the critical threshold is there danger to you or danger to somebody else? Or is there no danger? Okay. What other variables must be considered? Some other variables that must be considered are the scope and the degree of the rumors. In halacha, we distinguish between a rumor which is transient and a rumor which lasts for a long time. We make such a distinction. The stronger and longer the rumor, the more credence we have to give it, and the more that we have to weight our actions and our conduct in favor of pragmatism, the less we have to incorporate idealism into our code of conduct. The more transient the rumors, the weaker they are, the more we have to assume idealism. So the Maharik points this out. His example is actually where the rumor is spread by a known antagonist to the subject of the rumor. Clearly, such a rumor is very weak. It's being spread by his enemy. Chances are that the rumor is not true, the rumor is false. It's made up in order to get revenge on its subject. So that's another variable. You have to consider the strength of the rumor. But the strength of the rumor is just a subcategory of a broader question, which is, what are the probabilities? What are the probabilities of the rumors being true? And what are the probabilities of the rumor being false? One of the most complex areas of halacha is how to determine halachic probability. One factor which is relevant here, it's called a chezkas kashrus, a presumption of innocence, a presumption of goodwill, of good intentions, of goodness in general. There is a presumption that every Jew is good. And rumor is insufficient to contradict that presumption. Therefore, we have to discount the rumor unless for some reason the presumption is adequately challenged. However, it should be noted that the Chafetz Chaim brings down an opinion of the Maharshal, Rav Shlomo Luria, which would possibly lead one against this conclusion, which would lead one to believe that the chezkas kashrus, the presumption of innocence, is invalid in the face of even a transient rumor. Because the Maharshal says that the only reason in the situation of Rabbi Tarfon, of the suspected murderers who asked for asylum, the only reason in that case that Rabbi Tarfon did not hand them in is because we have to be lenient when it comes to life and death questions. We can't be stringent. If stringency would lead to someone losing their life, then we've got to be lenient. If there's any grounds for leniency, if there's any possibility of leniency. Obviously, if there's no possibility, then you can't be lenient. But if there's any possibility of leniency, we must grab it. It's a lifeline. It'll save the guy's life. That's why Rabbi Tarfon didn't turn these people in. Because if he turned them in, it would be akin to being stringent on a life and death question. It would be akin to signing them over to oblivion. If that were so, then any time where the rumor does not concern a life and death matter, any time where the potential consequences of pragmatism, where the conduct which pragmatism demands would not lead to the perishing of the rumor subject, then one would indeed be permitted or perhaps even obligated to adopt a more heavily pragmatic approach to the situation. The Chafetz Chaim rejects this. He does not think that this is a proper reading of the Marshal, but he does entertain this possibility. So in general, a person has to be well versed in the halachos of establishing probabilities before determining how to respond to the rumors, because the level of probability of the rumors being true based on halachic factors can influence the conduct which halacha demands of us. What other variables are relevant? There's a discussion in the Chafetz Chaim as well about who is the subject of these rumors. Does he have a clean record? If he does, so then we have to strive not to give credit to the rumors. But if his record is besmirched, if he has a history of criminal activity which is on par of the crime which he is currently accused of, then one may give greater credence to the rumors. This again falls under the same level of establishing the halachic probability of the rumor's truth. Just like the question of Chezkas Kashrus impacts on our assumption about the rumor's truth or untruth, just like the principle of Safik Nefashos Lahakel, of being lenient in life and death questions, impacts on our assumptions about the rumor's truth or untruth, so too the past conduct of the rumored criminal contributes to our evaluation of the truth or untruth of the rumors. Okay, looks like we're out of time. We really ought to wrap this up. Consider how it applies to the various scenarios. But truthfully, we haven't seen enough evidence to pin down accurately how we should respond in those scenarios. We've just seen the basic outlines and foundations of the topic. And Mirtz Hashem, at some later point in our studies, we should have an opportunity to delve into this more thoroughly and to arrive at a ready practical conclusion. Thank you for your attention.